Save big money now on new siding from LP Smart Side at Menards. Update and beautify your home with your choice of 13 timeless colors of pre-finished engineered siding. It's durable and includes a Sherwin-Williams factory finish paint warranty that means no painting for years to come. View our entire selection of siding from LP Smart Side today. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science in each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold. Welcome to episode 2 of Your Case is on Hold, covering issue 2, January 2022. We are here welcoming you back. I'm Andrew Schoenfeld, the Tony Romo of JBJS.
I'm Antonia Chen. I'm just part of the crew. I'm here for the laughs and the good times. How's that?
I'm here for the smiles. Couple of reminders for everyone. First off, this is brought to you by the Miller Review Course. So if you're interested in getting up to date on testable items for whatever reason, wherever you are in your career arc, definitely look into signing up for the MRC. The opinions that you are hearing today are mine and Antonia's and not reflective of the journal, the editorial board, the board of trustees, et cetera. Since word got out about the first episode, Antonia, a lot of people have been coming to me and saying, Drew, how do I get my work discussed on Your Cases on Hold? How do I get to be a part of this? And it's very simple. Submit your research to JBJS. It gets accepted. It's a scientific article. It's going to be discussed here. Simple as that. That's all it takes.
But wait, we have free reign to say whatever we want about it. So be careful if you want to say
Yeah, be careful what you wish for. Well, that's the other thing. Interesting segue. Other people have, you know, been saying, well, I mean, is this real? Is this like real insights? Are we going to be getting real stuff? Or is it all just rah-rah cheerleading for the contents in the journal? And on the one hand, yes, we are really covering everything that's in the journal. I encourage you to go into detail. If you think it's interesting, if you're intrigued, definitely check it out. We are going to be highlighting in each of these articles, if they're open access, if there's a visual summary, if there's an infographic. So you can definitely check out those additions to round out your experience with the articles. But also, we are definitely, when the time comes, we're going to put some things on hold. We're putting cases on hold here. And I'm about to prove that with my first headline. So we're going to go right into it. And the first headline is, this is Martin and colleagues predicting anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction revision using machine learning techniques. This work covers about 25,000 patients from a Norwegian registry. And certainly it hits excellent high points in terms of volume of cases, a lot of variety in the clinical variation, and it uses machine learning, which, as we know, is definitely one of the hot and trendy statistical analytic approaches. But at the same time, and there are going to be people who disagree with me on this, and I get that, at the same time, you have to be very careful about machine learning. And there are some people who really believe machine learning is going to bring us to this whole new place in science and in orthopedics. And that's great. And I'm not here to argue that particular point. And if you want to go into more detail, definitely check out Ortho Joe. Mark and Mo did a whole episode on machine learning. And I think they cover excellent points about the areas where you need to be careful with this methodology. Because machine learning is a methodology, just like regression, just like propensity score matching, just like all of those hot buzzwords that are out there. It's not in and of itself capable of leading you to the promised land. And when you talk to people who use machine learning, you say, okay, well, how does it work? They did the machine learning. They have an algorithm. They want you to use the algorithm. They want you to use the clinical algorithm to help inform how you're going to perform your ACLs and modify it based on revision risk. And you say, well, how does it work? And they say, well, yeah, I know how it works. You say, okay, well, tell me. They're like, well, I could tell you, but you might die. There's so much trust in the process. Trust the machine. The machine will tell you. It's like the machine also tells you to join the Borg.
It also tells you, it's like the Holy Grail, you're saying, like clip-clop, 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 clip-clop. Be sure you find the Holy Grail, because this is the only way to do things.
Assimilate to the Borg. Do the ACL my way. Absolutely. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. And what's most important is the clinical substrate in all of these. The tool is the tool. And the real advantage of machine learning is when you do one iteration and then you put in more information and more information and more information. So when your phone knows the hotspots that you want to go to buy your sweatshirt or whatever, or in scientific studies, when you're looking at the machine learns to identify those tiny areas on a CT scan that may be a sign of cancer or something occult and untoward. When you're using it as a one and done substitute for regression, I'm not sure in all ways you get that much more than what a regression is going to give you. So on the one hand, the science is interesting. If you want to learn about factors that may be influencing ACL revisions, particularly in this Norwegian context, definitely check it out. It is an open access article. They give you five risk factors: age, coups at the primary surgery, graft choice, femoral fixation device, and the time between the injury and the primary surgery. How those factor in, or if you're going to use that to inform what type of procedure you're going to do, that's the part that I think needs to be a little bit, not a little bit, but definitely on hold. I'm putting that part on hold. So there you go. It's not all rah-rah.
Put it in point. So what would take it to be less on hold? Is it more data? Is it from different areas? More opening up Pandora's box? What would take it off hold?
I think for this to come off hold, there has to be, this in and of itself has to be on hold. And then to apply it, what you're asking is you need more validation studies. They make a claim that they validated it the way all of the machine learning studies that follow this trope do, which is they do a testing set and they do a validation set, or a set that builds the model and then one that tests the model. But the substrate data is all coming from the same place. So when you randomly pull it out, it's likely that your 80% test is very similar to your 20%, you know, verification model. So I think for the whole concept to come together, for me to say this is clinically actionable, it should be used in practice, no questions asked, you have to have the prospective validation study with large sample, multi-center, all of those other pieces that come later. In and of itself, the study itself, you know, if you want to use it for your clinical practice, that's certainly, you're allowed to do that, of course. But the claim that, you know, use these, and because the machine told us, we asked the machine gave us these answers, now this is enshrined in stone. No, no way. This is an experiment. It's a study like any other. The experimental tool that they used is the machine learning algorithm. And then what you do with the results that it gives you is up to you. But if you're asking me, I'm not sure this is much better than what you would get had you run a well-substantiated and well-fit regression model on this same data, which they could have done because they have like 25,000 patients.
So I should say, this is good for a prediction, just talking to a patient and being like, these might increase your risk of revision, but not enough for me to hang my hat on.
So, and not enough that I think where you can say, well, I was going to do the hamstring autograft in you, but now I'm going to do the bone patellotendon bone in you because the machine told me so.
So you got to trust. It's resurrection that's come up, isn't it? This is resurrecting the ACL to another level. It's coming, but not as good as the original. So let's stick to the original, data, the original stuff. Go back to episode one and make sure it belongs that way and get all the data and then build from there. So, all right. So you're voting that your case is on hold. All right. So mine that I have Not as much on hold. I'm not so against it because I think the idea is good. I just think the numbers need to be larger. So the one I'm looking at is patients who do not receive aspirin because of allergy have an increased risk of venous thromboembolism following total joint apoplasty. So the hardest part that I had with this study is that it's a slightly biased sample, right? Only 1.8% reported an aspirin allergy. It's not a lot of patients. So they have this huge database of people. And again, the big numbers, you know, very similar numbers to the one you just studied. I mean, we're saying you have over 45,000 patients. So that's big, but only 1% of them reported an NSAID or an aspirin allergy. So not enough to hang my hat on. That said, though, it does ask an important question, I think, is that is aspirin our new gold standard for doing DVT prophylaxis and total joint replacement? You know, is this the way that we have to go in the future? Because to date, it really hasn't been demonstrated as the gold standard. But that's a question that I think it brings up. And then do we want to test these patients prior to surgery so we can give them aspirin afterwards for DVT prophylaxis? And that all opens up a Pandora's box, just like we do for penicillin allergy and everything like that, is if we start testing everyone, first, dermatologists or allergist specialists are going to love us because we're giving them pure business. But two, you know, is it one of those things where are we actually going to be giving them a better thing? And what they're saying in this study says, if you don't receive aspirin, then you have increased risk of venous thromboembolism. So I think part of it for me that I would take home is, you know, not that it's on hold, but I would dial it back a little bit and just say, okay, well, then just give aspirin to everyone because that's going to reduce your risk of VTE. But part of it's patient education. Like, what is your allergy to aspirin? You know, does your stomach get upset? Well, if it's upset, you know, Benadryl makes me sleepy, you know, that's epinephrine makes my heart race. Like, oh my gosh, of course, like it's working. That's a good thing, right? So what is a true allergy? You know, if your stomach gets upset, we can give you, you know, proton pump inhibitors, things like that, that can actually help you reduce the risk of VTEs. But I think the other thing that comes up too, is that if you look at one of the tables, it shows that most patients got warfarin. And warfarin is a very cheap drug. That's a wonderful thing, but you've got to monitor it. And when you first start it, it actually increases your risk of VTE initially because of how it works on the clotting cascade. So maybe we should be avoiding warfarin in these patients instead, and maybe that'll mitigate the risk. So, you know, I don't think aspirin is the holy grail. No, I personally use aspirin. I like it because it's great and it's easy for my patients to get and utilize, but I don't think it's necessarily the holy grail everyone says it is, but it does bring to light some of the important things. So this is not totally on hold. I actually like it as a useful piece to kind of springboard off of, but it will make me dig deeper into my patients who say, do I have allergies or not? I mean, I need to know the details.
There are definitely a lot of moving parts with this one. And that was a little bit challenging for me. It was like, not just the story about, we're asking the question about what happens if they can't be on aspirin, but then the, you know, subsequent additional two areas that they went into. And this does have a visual summary. So if you're like me and you're like, oh, I'm having some trouble following, you can just check out the visual summary in addition to the paper, and it definitely helps move things along.
I'm visual too, but our brains get dumber as we get older. Let's be honest. I can see things better that way. It's much better that way.
All right. We're now into the Your Case is on Hold featurette. This is, we're covering Chang and colleagues, the effect of sequential intravenous and oral tranexamic acid on hemoglobin drop after total knee arthroplasty and RCT. What do you got?
So it's an RCT, which is a beneficial thing, right? We need more of these. So that's a good thing. Two, most RCTs are interesting because they normally have a positive result. This showed this and they proved their hypothesis. So it's actually refreshing again to look at another paper and say it's an RCT and they're like, we didn't see a difference between populations. So that was one of those things where it made me pause and say, okay, this is interesting. So, you know, ortho is all about more is better. You know, if we give IV tranexamic acid, we might as well give oral, not just one day, but 2 days. Heck, why don't we just give them forever? You know, you get a tranexamic acid, you get tranexamic acid, Oprah can start giving out tranexamic acid. Yes. No one's business.
One of right? The favorite things. No.
You can get a car of tranexamic acid. One will save your hemoglobin, one will let you get to the hospital. So it's one of those things where more isn't better in this case, which is actually a refreshing find, I would say. I was surprised that they use CT scans for DVTs. I understand for PEs, but it looked like they use it for lower extremities too. So we don't routinely use it in our country. You know, I think ultrasound is more commonly used, so I was surprised to use that. But what's interesting, actually, talking about aspirin, because I have to bring it back to that, they only used 100 milligrams of aspirin daily for their DVT prophylaxis. And for me, I use 81 twice a day. So they used even less and still had a low rate of DVTs. So again, this goes back to the whole thing is, do we actually need all these things for DVT prophylaxis? But one thing I will say is that hemoglobin drops, looking at tranexamic acid and hemoglobin drops, it's been a game changer, right? We all have started using tranexamic acid throughout orthopedics, and it really has reduced our hemoglobin drops over time. So I think it's actually useful. Just give intravenous tranexamic acid the day of surgery, and it's easier to administer. So I think it's a decently well-done study looking at an interesting endpoint. Not many people, I think, have mixed them. Most people have tried to do one modality or another, or not both modalities. The one thing I thought was interesting, too, that's a little hard to translate across times is that we normally don't keep our patients in the hospital for that long. So in this study, they did keep patients a little bit longer, it looks like, or they followed them up with sequential timeframes more than we would in the U.S.
Yeah, and I think some of that is just unique to the clinical practice environment, which is, I think, something that it's nice that you brought that up because it's one of my points. It's a randomized controlled trial, and a lot of people like randomized controlled trials, and we're sort of taught, oh, it's an RCT. So now forget about the machine learning. This is the real truth, right? Because we did an RCT. But at the same time, it's relatively small numbers of patients. They powered it, meaning that they identified how many patients they would need based on showing differences in the change in hemoglobin. So that part was good, but the numbers are way too small to say anything about any of the venous thromboembolic events. I mean, those, you know, happen 1%, 2% of the time or something like that. And they only have somewhere around between 40 and 50 patients in each of their cohorts. And they were, the sample was powered for just 38 patients. So they went a little bit over prior to, you know, adjust for dropout or patients lost to follow-up. But, you know, the baseline risk factors may be different in this population than in a standard practice in, I don't know, Wisconsin or Minnesota or Massachusetts or New Mexico or Texas. And so it's not necessarily that this is showing us something that's a universal and an absolute truth. And I think that with the numbers being as small as they are in the individual cohorts, definitely an interesting study, definitely food for thought for those who are, you know, using TXA. And I think it's increasingly more and more utilized, as I understand it, in spine as well, actually. And, you know, some of these very large deformity surgeries. So there are definitely some advantages. But again, in the clinical application, it's buyer beware. And you have to decide, does this really seem like the practice that you're working in? And there's certainly room for more validation in this setting, I think.
Some more studies. So if you're listening, there's more work to be done.
There you go. We're not only doing like your show prep for your journal club, we're telling you the new research avenues to explore. What more could you ask for?
All right. To do so little time.
Toss up.
All right.
Factors influencing outcomes after non-operative treatment for patients with proximal humerus fractures.
So this is the one that gave me pause because I love to see a comparison study. So that's nice. They do better, or some do better, some don't do better. But I would love to see a comparison of patients who underwent fracture fixation, because obviously not all of them do great either. So it's not just, you know, if you get surgery, by the way, you'll do a lot better. So, you know, one of the things I could say is in potential patients who are younger, more active with greater fragment displacement or, you know, tuberosity displacement, you could potentially, you know, justify operative management, but are PROMs the only measure, right? And the answer is no, right? PROMs are good because it used to be, when I was a resident, the notes would be like, looks good, or patient feels good. And right. That was our patient reported yes. outcome, which was an outcome then. It just like when an infection was like, smells bad, you know, that was an indication. So PROMs are a good thing, but I don't know if they're enough to necessarily judge treatment this way or treatment that way per se. Maybe an improvement in PROMs is definitely different, or you know, a meaningful clinical difference in improvement, we said. So we don't want to fix or not fix a patient based on a number alone. So you do want to take a patient's, like, you know, psychosocial parameters into account and individualized care. You want to make sure that the expectations are managed before you decide between non-operative and operative. So I actually put this one a little bit on hold myself.
For those who are interested in checking this out, this is Goody and colleagues. It's from the UK. It is the cohort managed entirely non-operatively. I thought it was very nice that they include the Oxford shoulder score and then also the EQ5D. The EQ5D has the advantage of you're actually able to rate your quality of life like below deceased, like worse than death. So that expands the scale, and that is nice. At the same time, as you said, it is entirely a non-operative cohort. They're not really making that case, but I could see it easily being used by some people to inappropriately translate to saying like, well, everyone should have surgery because look how, you know, poorly that they're doing. And that would definitely be, if you're trying to do that, your case is on hold. I think it is very nice to see the factors that they identified as being influential, psychosocial factors, some fracture-related factors, displacement, non-union, tuberosity displacement. These are definitely important parameters that one could consider if you're entertaining non-operative treatment. But I mean, at the end of the day, this is limited in how much it can say on the clinical application side. This is another one of those that I think is sneaky influential, just because, again, it is methodologically sound. It has a relatively large sample across centers. This is one of those that you read it and say, yeah, okay, great, makes sense. Psychosocial factors, that sounds like stuff that I know. And then it's showing up on your ABOS. It's showing up on the written exam. It's OITE. It's maintenance of certification material. So definitely keep an eye out on this for the future. Prognosticating that this is going to show up on tests going forward.
The tally of these of what the Kaiser Sose is that
Kaiser Sose phenomenon, sneaky influential research. We're going to have to keep a tally going, and we'll 3 years from now check back and see how good I am with the. I don't have any lotto numbers though.
So. We're going to put a hashtag on this one. That's what we're going to do. Hashtag Kaiser Sose OITE surprise.
Right.
And make that the next go-to. I agree. But as you said, we want to be careful, right? Because you can use research for support or illumination. And hopefully this is not for support that just says, oh, let's just operate on anyone who's like older or displaced. You know, let's think about it first. So it's good to keep it in mind. But it will show up on tests because...
And conversely, I don't know that these patients, if they had surgery, might do any better, right?
That's the hard part.
That's the other point.
Right. So... that's the future to tell. Another study idea. All right. Hemoglobin 8, less than 8. Does that compromise total joint outcomes?
This is Chowdhury and colleagues, predictors and outcomes of postoperative hemoglobin less than 8. This is all out of Johns Hopkins. I think, of course, anemia before surgery or after surgery or in any contact is probably going to increase your risk of complications and adverse events, both in and of itself and because of all the other factors that are contributing to that phenomenon in and of itself. This is a highly correlated and collinear phenomenon with other bad actors in the medical comorbidity universe. It was, a study that used regression techniques. They made, numerous comparisons. It's a single center work. At the end of the day, the point for me that's kind of on hold is, these were people who had these parameters and yet they were still being indicated and moving forward with the surgery. And you don't know from retrospective work, you're not there to sort of understand that decision point. And that's probably the real missing piece here, as well as being able to comprehensively investigate all those other linked comorbidities that I'm referring to. So at the end of the day, it seems somewhat intuitive, but also how clinically actionable, that point again is on hold. And there's a real potential here for all of those confounders that enter the retrospective dialogue, selection bias, confounding by indication, even expertise bias. And those are things that you'd have to consider. I mean, why are these patients moving forward with the surgery when they're having these risk factors to begin with?
So, I mean, we're total joint arthroplasty surgeons. We only know one phenomenon, and that's the cut. You have a pulse, I can get ANSEF through that pulse, I will cut you. So that's a factor of the total joint surgeon, and that's a problem. So I was like, oh, well, it does compromise outcomes. End of story, period. So you're right. That's one thing that we definitely have to be cognizant of. And this is a retrospective studies, you say. So our preoperative optimization has only really come to being probably over the last, 5 years or 10 years, I would say. And we focus more on this now. We didn't used to focus on it before, right? People who smoked, who had high BMI, who had diabetes, anyone who had a leg, you got surgery. It was great because you had indicated arthritis, and had to be treated. But now I think this really brings to light that we do have to optimize patients beforehand, and the key factors I would say is they didn't look at things like modifiable risk factors, like what were their iron levels? What were their vitamin B12 levels? What were their folate levels, right? What are things like that they could have tanked up ahead of time? But what I, definitely want to tell surgeons is that, even if you don't optimize patients, right? If you don't transfuse a patient, they can still have these complications, right? It's not like, well, okay, well, they've dropped under 8, but they're asymptomatic, but they'll be fine. They still can have complications after surgery, right? So, you know, take home messages is that, yes, why are these patients being operated on? Let's optimize them beforehand. And two, you know, if they have these parameters, you know, if you transfuse, if you don't transfuse, you still can have these, you know, side effects or, you know, the comorbidities of, you know, longer stay, more ED visits, greater admission, and acute kidney injury. So be careful with these patients. Obviously, transfusions have their own problems too, right? There's infection, there's other problems that can come with the disease transmission, things like that. We obviously screen a lot of it. And plus, if we're doing these patients, surgeries in patients who hemoglobin under 8, we're keeping the transfusions from people who really might need it, you know? So if we could keep that from happening, then we can actually give it to patients who actually need the transfusions for other reasons that are not preventable before surgery.
So in this one, it's like we're going from that orthopedic meme, there is a fracture, to now there is knee osteoarthritis.
You must fix it.
Knee osteoarthritis belongs to a knee.
The patient
is anemic. They're like, I've not heard of this condition before.
Although anemia versus asystole, I mean, I would take anemia over asystole.
Yeah, asystole wins on that one.
So that's just the baseline. All right, this last one for this toss-up. Structural allografts for massive segmental distal femoral metaphyseal bone defects after open injury.
Now, this is from Dr. Rajasekaran's group in Coimbatore, India. Very illuminative work on 20 consecutive patients with large metaphyseal bone defects. I think it's, you know, a very interesting read to understand their experience with this kind of technique. Again, it's only 20 patients. This would be viewed as more of a epidemiologic natural history type study than a research investigation that was conducted with like a hypothesis-driven intent. I think, again, the selection, the confounding by indication, the potential for expertise bias, especially in this setting. And those are just things that need to be taken into account. I think their conclusions are certainly well-founded based on their experience. It doesn't mean that their experience is going to be your experience in your clinical context if you are seeking to apply this. That remains to be shown.
I wanted to just high-five these guys for doing these surgeries. So I just want to thank the surgeons for taking these cases on. My real question, since I'm a female and you're a male, is why are so many males getting in trouble? The percentage is 18 men and 2 women in these, you know, big segmental defects. So I don't know what you guys are doing, but you need to protect your femurs a little bit better. So whether or not you guys are going cross, whatever you guys are doing that are taking huge risks, just be careful is what I want to say. But yeah, all you said from a methodological standpoint is all important. It is a small patient population. And in general, you know, in this population, a good outcome is 68%, which is, you know, pretty good, you know, and being able to maintain their allografts and things like that. One thing that that pointed out to me, just because, you know, I love the wonderful world of infection, is that there's a 21% infection rate, which is not surprising to anyone probably, but should we be doing something to these allografts that actually make them better in the future? And this is something to think about, you know, tether antimicrobials, tether antibiotics, you know, how do we improve outcomes from a clinical perspective, not from a, you know, stylistic methodological perspective. So food for thought, but you said exactly right. Just take it as it is. This is one group's experience. You may not have the same experience if you use the same grafts or the same large defects. And we're talking about 10-centimeter defects. We're talking about big defects, but things that are applicable. So interesting.
All right. On to the big finish. We're going to have to go fast here. Antonia, are you still operating on patients with inflammatory bowel disease? This is the inflammatory bowel disease increases the risk of PJI.
I wouldn't want to discriminate against my IBD patients, so I still operate on them. It's not a cutoff variable for surgery, which includes factor, just as we said before, like BMI, hemoglobin A1C, and smoking. But the real question is, and it's just like our hemoglobin paper that we discussed earlier, is how can I optimize these patients prior to surgery? So I do want to I still want to operate on these IBD patients, but how can I reduce their likelihood for PJI? And the authors from Rothman Institute really make a point. They're like, maybe it's the gut microbiome. Maybe we have to work on that. You know, do we give probiotics in these patients and can they reduce the risk of aseptic loosening and infection? Or what can I do as a surgeon to improve the immunity and reduce the likelihood of bacteria entering the bloodstream at the time of surgery? You know, just like the allografts and the segmental defects, you're like, you know, can I put in antimicrobials? Can I put in antibiotics so it doesn't go across the membrane and it doesn't increase the risk of infection? So the answer is yes, I still operate on them, but I do I would use this as a study with patients and say, look, your risk of infection is greater, and this is why, but can we optimize it and just be cognizant of this as well?
I definitely think that's the take-home message there.
All right. Sacral fractures and if they're total hip replacement, is it clinically actionable?
Yes, this is the study by Grawl and colleagues out of Eisenberg, Germany. Very interesting, 171 patients. They're really identifying the insufficiency fracture first and then looking to see if they have a hip arthroplasty and then whether it was on the ipsilateral side or the contralateral side. I would say that alone, just kind of like an interesting experience, raises some questions. But then they went a step further and they had this other group of patients where they examined the bone mineral density following the total joint replacement. And they showed different types of remodeling on either side with greater risk on the contralateral side. So that, I think, definitely is food for thought. This has an infographic, so definitely check that out.
And I don't want to be causing problems to my patients by doing total hip replacements. So it's interesting information.
All right. The last one. What can we do about the weather at the time kids are born? This is a cold weather as a risk factor for the late diagnosis and surgery of developmental dysplasia.
From Lee et al. From my home country of Taiwan. So it's easy. Just have babies during the summer months. Then you'd be done. You don't have to worry about it. And you're up from that. So dysplasia is much more common among East Asian patients, which is where the study is from in Taiwan. So in some ways, it's a good public service announcement for patients in that part of the world. More importantly, and I can attest to this growing up in a household like this, maybe they should just turn up the temperature in the house when babies are born so that it won't be swaddled as tightly so that we don't have to reduce our risk of dysplasia in the cold weather months. I grew up in a household where cold was good because it saved money for heat, which is a good thing. Except that means I was swaddled more. So I have not had my hips checked. But that said, this is a Taiwanese database study. So it's nice because you can follow these patients for a long period of time, which is ideal. It's the same one, you know, national healthcare system. So they can actually see that. Another endpoint was operative management, which is, you know, what we look at. Ideally, it'd be nice to be able to look at more than just operative management for it. And you can follow up if they get, you know, total hip replacements or, you know, things in the future where they're, you know, dysplasia kind of translated. But those cold months are bad. So have babies in the summer. And turn the temperature up so you don't have to swaddle as tightly. So be careful how you swaddle.
Yeah, I definitely think the swaddling thing is the correlated factor there for sure. And that's something that has been talked about. At this point, unfortunately, we're out of time. We'll try to do better next time. What you can do in the meantime is subscribe, go to jbjs.org, check out those articles that intrigue you. Hopefully you came away from this episode entertained, a little bit more informed, intrigued, interested. We got Oprah this time. I think we covered Star Trek, the Borg.
Monty Python.
We got Kaiser Soze again. So
Monty Python again. The Monty Python.
Mighty Python, yes, the Holy Grail, absolutely. So you know, check all those Easter eggs and keep a running list going. We'll keep trying to throw them in there. At the end of the day, this still remains case still on hold.
And hopefully it comes off hold sometime. We see you at the next episode. We'll see you then.